We've heard from Jill that the disciples had been out in ministry and they'd seen a measure of success, and this news had percolated to King Herod Antipas, and he's the Herod who's mentioned most in the Gospels associated with Jesus' ministry time. And when he heard about this, he said, "John, whom I beheaded, has been raised from the dead." I think he had a guilty conscience. Well, the love life of the aristocracy in New Testament times was interesting. Both Jewish aristocracy, as here, but also Roman aristocracy. King Herod the Great, who was the one who was mentioned at the beginning of Luke's Gospel when Jesus was born, had at least five wives. He had at least eight sons and one daughter. He murdered one of his wives, three of his sons, and other relatives because he was paranoid. He was a paranoid homicidal maniac, basically. And when anybody threatened him, he did away with them. He rubbed them out. They slept with the fishes, to use a mafia term. Anyway, his fifth son from his fourth wife, his fourth wife gave birth to a son, and it was the fifth son. It was Herod Antipas, or Herod the Tetrarch. And he's the one mentioned in this passage from Mark. Herod Antipas was the ruler of Galilee, which is where Jesus' main ministry was, and Perea, just across the Jordan, from 4 BC, when his father died, to 39 AD. Herod Antipas had a political marriage, marrying the daughter of Aretas IV, who was the king of Nabatea. Nabatea is the ancient kingdom in the general area of southwestern Jordan, and it's known for its primary center of Petra, which, if you've watched Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, that is Petra. This sunken, carved-out city in the middle of the desert. But the Nabataeans were wealthy. Why? Well, because myrrh, frankincense, and other spices were grown down the southern area of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. And they had to come up through that part of Saudi Arabia where Jeddah and Mecca and all those places are. And they ended up at Petra. And Petra controlled that trade. And the trade went from Petra across to Gaza, which is the port where they exported it to the general Roman world. So they were fairly wealthy and they had armies and all that sort of stuff. So Aretas IV thought, a marriage of my daughter, who was called Phasaelis, would be a good thing to cement my relationship with Herod Antipas, because there's sometimes trouble over the border, disputes over border. And so he had his daughter marry Herod the Tetrarch, Herod Antipas. And they'd lived together for some time. But Herod went to visit his brother in Rome, one of his brothers, Herod Philip. And while he was there, he fell in love with Herod Philip's wife, who was called Herodias, who was actually both of their nieces. She was the niece of both of them, because they were her uncles. And she was the daughter of another half-brother called Aristobulus. And she agreed to marry Herod Antipas and divorce her husband Herod Philip, as long as he got rid of Aretas' daughter, Phasaelis. All right, you're with me so far? I don't know if it's like Dynasty or one of the other soaps, but anyway, it's rather like a soap opera. Anyway, Phasaelis, the daughter of Aretas, found out. Don't know how, but servants talk. You know, there's servants waiting around, and they hear and see everything that's going on in these aristocracies' houses. Anyway, she asked her husband, "Well, do you mind if I go down to Machaerus, near to where my father is?" So he allowed her to go down to Machaerus. Machaerus is a fortress across the Dead Sea from the caves of Qumran and Masada. Okay? And that was one of Herod's big fortresses on the border with the Nabataeans. So she went there, and as soon as she got there, didn't tell her husband Herod about this. She thought, right, now I'm near where my father is, I will escape. So she left Machaerus and went with various of the generals of her father and arrived safely at her father's house and told him about what Herod planned to do. So you can imagine, Aretas was not best pleased that his daughter was being put aside for some totty of some other person's husband. Anyway, John the Baptist appears on the scene and says, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. And this is where the trouble started, because Herodias felt guilty enough probably about divorcing her first husband and putting away this other woman in order to get Herod Antipas. And so Herod gave orders to have John arrested, had him put in prison, which was in Machaerus, this place across the Dead Sea, where the first wife had been for a little while before she escaped back to her father. So he was in prison, and Herod, like our queen, has various fortresses or palaces where they move around at different times of the year. Anyway, they happened to be there on one occasion when he had all the military leaders from Galilee. And this is the occasion when Herodias' daughter was invited to dance. The commentators say it was probably a lascivious dance, and that's why it pleased everybody. And that's why the opportunity came with Herod's boast and his foolish promise to get John the Baptist executed. Because as soon as Salome is invited to ask for anything she wants, she asks her mother, and her mother says immediately, the head of John the Baptist. So I think it was premeditated. And duly he was executed. And can you imagine bringing out the head of a prophet freshly cut on a wooden plate and presenting it before the palace guests and military commanders? It's gruesome. I want to give a sort of counterbalance to what Chris was saying just now, and some of the rest of you, about the miraculous and God working. Because there is a tendency within our brand of Christianity, and other brands too, to overemphasize miracles and the exciting, triumphal nature of being a Christian. Which is okay, because, you know, there are truths in that side of things. But it's not the whole story about being a Christian. And it is not adequate to cope with the reality of the experiences of our lives and of the variation in our human personalities. And the trouble is, if we overemphasize the miraculous, we can perhaps be okay. People can be okay with that for a while, but when reality hits in different ways and God doesn't always come through with a miracle, they might get disillusioned and fall away. And the trouble is sometimes we publicize our successes, but not our failures. But that was corrected this morning. Anyway, I think Mark is trying to correct such a one-sided view. John the Baptist's discipleship was not miracles all the way. And actually, it wasn't the pattern of Jesus' obedient sonship either. So in detailing how John the Baptist died, maybe Mark is saying, this is what's going to happen to Jesus, and it's a way of true discipleship. It's not failure, it's actually part of God's plan. There is a price to pay for following Jesus, and for John the Baptist, he paid the ultimate price. Because gospel effectiveness, being effective as a Christian, doesn't always produce a widespread warm response. The New Testament that Mark is mentioning here is a world in which Jesus will soon be murdered, like John. Even though many people like John listened to him, some were drawn towards what he said, the good news, and yet still rejected it. And it's the world into which Jesus sends his disciples, both today and in those days. It's a world where political power is hugely significant. Like today, if you think of what it's like a game show on television with the comings and goings of some world leaders. It's a corrupt world where powerful men can get the women that they want, and how a powerful woman's hatred can get away with awful injustice, and how a young girl can manipulate her newly discovered power over men to terrible ends. So what does being faithful to the end look like in our society and our world of today? Well, I'm not a conservative voter, but I think Theresa May is trying in her own way as a Christian to be faithful to the end of the process that she's involved in at the moment. She's pleasing almost nobody and getting shot at from all sides, but she's doing her best. She's trying to be faithful to the end. Well, what are the guidelines about being faithful for us then? Well, there are two main ones, and Jesus mentioned them. Teacher, what's the great commandment in the law? And Jesus said to this person, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. This is the first and great commandment. The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. In other words, they sum up the whole of the Old Testament or First Testament. So loving God and loving our neighbor are the twin polarities within which give us guidelines about how to be faithful in our own particular context. Actually, would you like just to talk to your neighbor just for a minute or two about what you feel in your own life and context you are called to be faithful about? What is being faithful for you in your own life? 2 minutes. In one's own circumstances, whether it's in your family or friends or leisure pursuits or work, is that it's not easy. It's not easy. John the Baptist was faithful in his context because he relayed to Herod Antipas what God wanted for family life. And he paid a price. But actually, Herod Antipas also paid a price. Shortly after John the Baptist and Jesus were put to death, Aretas, remember him? The father of the spurned daughter went to war with Herod about a border dispute and won. Herod was defeated. Herod then appealed to Caesar, and Caesar instructed the governor of Syria, a Roman soldier, to raise an army and come against Aretas. But actually, that Caesar died before it could be put into practice, so it was all forgotten about. The next Caesar who came along didn't like Herod Antipas, took him away from the throne, and in 39 AD he was exiled to Lyon in Gaul or France. Now, there's worse places to be exiled to, but if you're someone who's been accustomed to living in Rome and glorious palaces in Galilee, Lyon's probably not such a good place, and he died there. Anyway, that's Herod Antipas. But everyone's life is different. So being faithful to God and to people has to be acted out in different ways in our own particular context. And there's no one way to be faithful. But remember those guidelines of loving God in this circumstance and loving our neighbour and needing to think and pray for ourselves, praying that God will show us. And being faithful at any given moment when we're called upon to do something. And how often do we fail that test? But anyway, sometimes faithfulness involves sticking with people even when we think that they are wrong. There's a prophet in the Old Testament called Jeremiah. God gave him the task of declaring to the people of Israel, or Judah, that they were going astray, they needed to change their ways, otherwise God would use the external powers to judge them, including Babylon. They steadfastly ignored him. In fact, he was locked up in a prison for his pains, rather like John the Baptist was to be many hundreds of years later. And Jeremiah stayed in prison, and in due time, yes, the Babylonians invaded and marmalized Jerusalem and took away the people into exile. Jeremiah was released from prison. And the puppet governor of the emasculated state of Judah was left, and Jeremiah stayed with him. But then this new governor was assassinated. And the people who assassinated him took Jeremiah and a lot of the people down towards Egypt because they were afraid of retribution from the Babylonians. Jeremiah went with them. And while he was in Egypt, the last we hear of Jeremiah is he's busy prophesying God's will, not just for the surrounding nations, but also for the Jewish people. And then we hear no more. Jeremiah was faithful to the end. He went with people even though they were making bad decisions and doing wrong things and believing wrong stuff. But he stuck with them because that was God's calling for him. And what does being faithful to the end, like John the Baptist, Jesus, Jeremiah, and quite a lot of other people that you could think of, what does it give us then? What's on offer for us? Well, not much more, but it does offer a sense that we're living according to what is true. We are, however imperfectly, trying to walk with Jesus. We're trying, however imperfectly, to give ourselves in love to serve God and his world. Our reward is not success. It's not how many likes we get in Facebook for our actions and our love. But it's the knowledge that we're actually faithfully serving God in his purposes for our world through the circumstances of your life and mine. Faithful to the end. I want to be faithful to the end. Not very successful about it, but I want to be. I'm going to finish with a prayer from a Spaniard called Ignatius of Loyola, who founded the Jesuit order. And he prayed this. Teach us, good Lord, to serve thee as thou deservest, to give and not to count the cost, to fight and not to heed the wounds, to toil and not to seek for rest, to labor and not to ask for any reward, save that of knowing that we do thy will. Amen.